I'm from men, you're from white, perfect strangers in the night.
It took a lot of balls to play some Balearic to this crowd, and little did I realize this was the next thing.
Welcome to the New York Times Podcast, your warm breeze of music criticism. I'm your host, Ben Ratliff.
My heart's alive, firestorms, and when they strike, we feel the love. Sparks will fly, they ignite our bones, and when they strike, we light up the world.
And you're hearing Firestone by the Norwegian artiste Kygo. Our guest today is Michelangelo Matos. Hey, Michael.
Hey.
You wrote a piece about Kygo and about the larger tendency that he's presently part of.
Tendency is a good word.
called Tropical House.
Yes.
Michael, you were present at the sort of Dylan Goes Electric moment of Kygo, except instead of loud electric guitars, it was the sound of synthetic marimbas.
It would be more like Dylan Goes soft synth.
Tell us what happened. You were in Atlanta.
I was covering.
2014?
Yeah, it was 2 years ago. I was covering, or a year and a half ago more properly, and I was covering the Tomorrow World Festival for Beatport. And I was watching the main stage. The sun is setting. It's probably about 7 o'clock. And suddenly they've got this new guy on. The stage looks like Castle Grayskull from the He-Man cartoon. And so, like, there's fire belching out of it on the sides. There's a waterfall. It's ridiculous. And suddenly there's this guy up there. You know, it looks like every other guy up there. He's playing stuff. And I'm like, I'm sort of drawn to it because I'm thinking, this sounds really weird. What is this doing here? Because it's really slow. It's about half the tempo, or it feels half the tempo of what had been playing before, which is mostly very bosh stuff. What I remember about this is I wasn't there ready and present to do this. I actually wandered over like, oh, what's going on the main stage? You know, is that a pan flute?
Yeah.
And I'm walking over and I'm like, everybody's standing still, but they're all looking. And I'm thinking, how bizarre that this guy is playing this half-tempo Balearic music.
You're literally like following the piper.
Sort of.
Yeah.
But I was more following like an EDM version of Balearic. That's crazy. I had never encountered that.
A concept we will return to in
a
minute.
Yes. For the nonce, Balearic just means slower and more 80s sounding, mm-hmm. more pop sounding, that sort of thing. So I'm following this thing and I'm watching these kids who are super into it. They're getting into it. You can see them change their minds about this within 10 minutes. They're all like rooting for it. They're grooving. And I'm sort of like, this is insane. How did that happen? And then I find out the guy's name is Kygo. And I think I actually tweeted something about, oh, wow, it took a lot of balls to play some Balearic to this crowd. And little did I realize this was the next thing. Mm-hmm. I didn't think it was anything other than an anomaly at the time.
So Kygo was a substitute at that festival,
yeah,
right?
Avicii was supposed to play. He was sick. He had to cancel a lot of his festival dates. So they bring in Kygo. I think like a lot of younger producers, even younger than Avicii, who is probably by now in his mid-20s, which for EDM is ancient.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he comes on and you're expecting, you know, big guitar sounds. You're expecting like – you're expecting Wake Me Up. Because this is Avicii's big hit. He's already like it's been saturating the air for the last few months at that point. And then all of a sudden it's just trilling pan flute and 100 beats per minute. People were going crazy.
Which we should say is quite comfortably slow.
Very
slow. It's like slower than things need to
be. Dunka, 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 like that.
Like soul to soul.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. In an earlier podcast,
mm-hmm.
Popcast, we have talked about Omi.
Yes.
Omi's Cheerleader.
Mm-hmm.
The Felix Yen remix, which was one of the enormous Shazam-fueled success stories of last year, I guess?
Yeah, it was number one in July.
Part of 2014 as well?
Yeah. The original track is earlier.
Yeah.
It's older.
Yeah.
And then this remix is the one that went to number one last July.
Right. So when you were seeing this moment with Kygo, had that crowd completely twigged to the Felix Yen remix of Cheerleader already?
Yeah, they must have, because the EDM audience, for as different in structure as EDM is to pop music in some ways, you know, that's a pop crowd. When you go to a big festival like Electric Zoo or something like that, the biggest cheers are always for the big pop hits, and you hear a lot of them because that's what the EDM audience likes.
Right.
They want to dance to stuff that's familiar, I think, more than they want to dance to stuff that's unfamiliar, which is more of a thing that you see in older dance music heads.
Yeah.
They would have certainly known that track by then. It was a number one hit, so yeah.
You're assuming that that's the connection they made in their minds. Like, I kind of get the context for this.
Sort of, but I would actually say in some ways, and again, this is pure guesswork, one of the things when I talked to Kygo and I talked to another producer that I didn't quote in the piece, but everybody discovers music on SoundCloud. They subscribe to a handful of SoundCloud things. That's what they check every day.
Sure.
So Kygo is somebody who started off making remixes of Ed Sheeran songs.
Yeah.
Acoustic songs that he could add stuff to without there being a lot of clutter when he couldn't find the acapellas. Those remixes had already gained traction by then. At that point, he must have been in talks with the labels that because he talked to pretty much every major label and a few independents before he signed. He signed to Ultra RCA, and that's basically – that would have been right when that was starting to happen. Mm-hmm. So though, you know, I'm sure a lot of the people at that festival knew those remixes at the very least.
Right. Just for reference at this point, I think we should play a little bit of the Felix Yen remix of Omi's Cheerleader. Here it is. Do you need me? You think I'm pretend? Do I make you feel like cheating? Like, not really close. Oh, I think that I found myself a cheerleader. She is always right there when I need her. Oh, I think that I found myself a cheerleader. She is always right there when I need her. She loves like a mother. That is the Felix Yen remix of Omi's Cheerleader, one of the biggest songs of last year. I need you to help me a little more, Michael, figure out where this came from.
You know, there's a lot of 80s pop in it. Somebody from GQ actually, you know, described Tropical House as sounding like Toto's Africa with a dance beat, and that's pretty accurate. Mm-hmm. The difference, I think, is that they're using a lot of, you know, online soft synths and plugins to make the music so it sounds markedly different. And it has that sort of post-EDM sonic profile that I think, you know, draws in that audience in a way that maybe actual 80s pop might sound old to them.
Right. So this
pure
is,
guesswork.
This
but
is just sort of scientific stuff in terms of what appeals to their ears.
Yeah.
Sounds and dynamics. And
amateur scientific in my case.
Sure. But we're talking about, in Kygo's case, sort of marimba-like sounds.
Yeah.
We're talking about sounds that approximate snapping, finger snapping.
Mm-hmm. A lot of waterfalls.
Waterfalls. All this.
Seagulls.
Suggests a feeling of relaxation and heat.
Yeah, a little
moving
heat.
Slowly in the heat.
Yeah, yeah.
Something that you would put on at a dance party, an outdoor dance party where it's very hot.
Right, exactly. Yeah. That stems from the Balearic thing I was talking about earlier.
Yeah.
Very briefly, Balearic just means slower, mid-tempo sort of dance music, sometimes not dance music. But it's basically the word for the sort of stuff that you would hear in late 80s Ibiza, particularly the DJ Alfredo Florito or DJ Alfredo, who was the person who inspired a lot of the British the people who's founded British Rave, essentially.
Right.
He was the DJ that they all heard high on ecstasy or MDMA or Molly or whatever they're calling it these days and went back to England and started the nights that turned into the phenomenon.
So it was an aesthetic created by DJs and it had to do with a certain kind of tempo, like below 120 beats per minute.
It went above sometimes. Like, this is 87 or so. So you really have to be able to manipulate things to get everything to beat match exactly. And at that point, beat matching wasn't necessarily necessary even for a nightclub DJ.
Right.
Yeah, it was an aesthetic, and that's what it reminded me of when I heard him at Tomorrow World. I was like, oh, they've moved backwards into this sort of thing now. It's like that sound and that style is so foundational within dance music.
That aesthetic mm-hmm. has always been kind of an underground current, right?
I mean,
it's never totally gone away.
That's right.
So when you formulated it like that in your head, I think that's what Kai goes on to, you must have felt a little bit excited.
A little bit, yes. I wasn't super into it as music and remain that way, but I feel like it was, I certainly at the time felt like it was a fascinating development.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, they've all burnt themselves out banging their heads and pumping their fists to E.G. Skrillex or to Afrojack. They want something slower. This is the way that every kind of musical genre evolves. It takes a left turn after 5 or 6 years because the other sound or the other style just sort of plays itself out.
Is there an exoticism going on here?
Oh, yes. I wouldn't say that it's an exoticism of any particular people or thing. I would say it's more along the lines of one of the key things that you see a lot of with festivals is what they call the after movie. They'll do like a 20-minute, you know, super cut of the highlights that they happen to catch at a festival, and then they'll like cut it together and put it online, and it'll get millions of hits, and it acts as a sort of ad for the next festival.
Sure.
This music is almost like that, except with vacation. There's this whole industry around techno tourism, and there always has been, but with EDM, which is very markedly different in sort of scope and style and audience than dance music per se.
Yeah.
EDM is the stuff they play at festivals. It's a tautology, but it's really more of a you can't say EDM is a genre. It's more of a and I'm borrowing from Eric Weisbard, but it's a format.
Yeah.
This stuff is very different from, you know, earlier ambient, or it's not coming from the same reference. The people who are making it don't really know or care much about that earlier stuff. Mm. You know, this happened organically and naturally to them. But, you know, it definitely has this second or third hand feel of the ultimate vacation. There is very much an aspirational thing there mm-hmm. that has, I think, a lot sort of socially to do with, you know, the way the tech culture sort of valorizes work, you know, work and play at the same time,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
if that's not overthinking it too much.
Right. So let's just quantify this for a minute. How popular is Tropical House?
It's very popular. In the piece, there's a little bit of fudging because I talk mostly about how it's doing on Chill, the Sirius XM station.
Yeah.
And that's partly because when I'm out working at cafes in New York, I hear that station half the time.
I see.
Mm-hmm. I hear it a lot. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's sort of the home listening version of that music. It's like the EDM audience is getting a little older and they don't want to dance all the time. They want something to just listen to maybe.
Is it one of the more popular Sirius XM channels for music?
Yeah, it is. And uh-huh. I think it has basically gotten more popular as it's focused more on this stuff has gotten more popular.
Okay.
Obviously, the Cheerleader remix is a number one. When Coldplay is commissioning you to remix them, you're getting pretty damn visible.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one way of it.
And then a certain number of plays on Spotify or
yes.
one of the people SoundCloud or whatever.
Ben Harvey, who programs Chill, told me that you see a lot more Chill playlists just from regular people on Spotify, and that those have more followers mm-hmm. than a lot of others. You know, he talked about 500,000 followers. I didn't ask for examples and he didn't give me them, but mm-hmm. I'm taking his word. Kygo's SoundCloud page is full of stuff. You see a lot of different people. Thomas Jack, the producer who actually came up with the term. And of course, mm-hmm. this is a controversial term in dance music because older, and it's very much like deep house. For years, deep house meant dark, moody, very black, very African-American rooted house music.
Right.
And now it kind of means just plain house
right.
for a lot of younger people. I think for a lot of people, it means not shallow house as
right.
opposed to actual depth. And Disclosure changed that. You know, we are very much in a post-Disclosure dance music era. When they came along, I remember seeing them in Miami 3 years ago When I was working on the book, I went to Ultra. They were playing on a live stage with seats, and there were maybe 500 kids there when they started. And by the time they finished, it was packed out. Mm-hmm. So it was like, oh, this is changing. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize the extent to which it was going to change. I just knew that they were really popular. They come along, they change the tempo, they make everything less frantic and more like spacious sounding.
Right.
And that creates a whole new thing for a lot of that audience, which does not have the foundation in dance music that older dance heads do.
So Tropical House is definitely post-disclosure music.
Yeah.
So you were talking about the semantic thing.
Yeah.
What did tropical used to mean in dance music?
The thing with the term tropical house is that once upon a time, and I think it's worth saying that with a lot of dance music descriptors or genre names, they literally exist to describe the music. I think there's a lot of misconception that this stuff is there to like, no, this is a wall and you can't go past it. No, it's there to tell you what it sounds like and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
So tropical house prior to that would have been a purely descriptive term, and it would have probably meant something very Latin, something with a lot of Latin influence in it. And
you
then
mean actually made by Latin people?
Not always.
Uh-huh.
A good example for me would be the song Bingo Bango by Basement Jaxx.
Yeah.
Basement Jaxx did really great, you know, tropical fusion, Latin-infused stuff. Masters at Work, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Totally Latin producers. You wouldn't call everything they did that, but, you know, when it has that feel, you would use that description. Another more recent example would be the New York label Duddy Arts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they very much, that whole crew calls themselves tropical,
right,
meaning they are south of the border and they are fusing things.
Right.
Whereas this comes out of a place that has no real knowledge of that music.
Yeah.
So older heads like Maria Stamper, the Black Madonna, who I quote in the piece, I asked her for a quote because she had actually tweeted last year, tropical house, neither tropical nor house discuss.
Uh-huh.
So I naturally had to ask her. But yeah, like for a lot of older heads, this sort of stuff is just like, what are you talking about? You don't know what you're talking about. And the younger kids, they don't. I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I, at 40, know how a 23-year-old thinks, but I'm guessing that stuff is a lot of older stuff is irrelevant to them musically.
So it's neither tropical nor house.
Mm-hmm.
In your conversations with Kygo,
mm-hmm,
you alluded to the term Balearic.
I asked him straight up, and I asked another producer I spoke with and didn't quote, and neither of them were really familiar with the term. And I can't say that I was mad about it. I can't say that I don't understand why. I mean, they're not coming from the same place I am, and I don't just mean because I'm older.
Did part of you think that maybe he was evading the question?
No, he wasn't evading it at all.
Did he know what Balearic
meant? No, not at all. No, he didn't know.
You didn't sense that?
Once I explained it to him, I said, do you know the term? And he said, I'm not familiar with it. And I said, it means this. And he said, oh, I think I've heard that before.
Yeah.
I think I've heard that before. Like, it's not like an instantly familiar sort of a term.
Right.
Little snap for the tropical house.
We should have been more on mic, though. There you go. This suggests a very deep ahistoricism.
Yes. People who don't like or get dance music just think of it as the sort of cheap, stupid thing with that is sort of ahistorical.
They think, right. If they're looking at it from the outside, they think it's fundamentally ahistorical. It's just about movement and feeling good.
Right.
Yeah.
Whereas within dance music, you couldn't possibly be more wrong because dance music is very much about the dialogue between the, you know, older music and new usages of it.
Yeah.
Not just samples, but certain instruments, certain machines.
Sure. Within dance music, you're talking about the makers of
and the dancers.
And people like you.
Yes, exactly.
Who write about it and follow it. I mean, the
diehards.
The erudition of what you've written about dance music is sometimes frightening to me. I mean, really.
Well, I better cross that off my list.
Well, no. I mean,
frightened Ben Ratliff.
Yeah, that's
check.
Right. That's right. What about all those people crammed into the tent at Tomorrow World?
This was the main stage, in fact. This was outdoors. This was 50,000
gathering around
kids.
The main stage at Tomorrow World. Are they ahistorical?
Yes.
They are.
Absolutely.
And is this a marked
this is
marked change in dance music audiences?
only in the sense that we haven't until the last 6 years or so seen anything of its like in the United States. I think for a lot of that audience, the roots of dance music are things like Black Box and Crystal Waters, things that were pop hits in the early 90s.
Yeah.
Because that's their referent. I think a lot of the kids who are into this stuff are coming to it as a pop phenomenon. They're not looking at it as any kind of subculture. And it makes sense. It does make sense for somebody who's 22, who doesn't, you know, who isn't grounded in dance music fundamentals or history.
Mm.
There's no reason for an average 22-year-old to be grounded. They're coming to it because their friends do this.
Yeah.
You know, they're
sure.
It's just a wholly different audience and a wholly different sort of value system. This is pop. They are seeing this as pop, even if older adults who are into pop just cannot see this as pop to save their lives.
That shift is, I think, one of the things that led you to write your book.
Yes.
No?
Specifically, what led me to write the book was watching the press botch everything about what was going on in 2011.
We're talking about your book that came out in the middle of last year?
It came out in April.
In April of 2015.
And called, the paperback is this April.
Good. Called The Underground is Massive, How Electronic Dance Music Conquered America. Excellent book.
Thank you.
Useful book. It'll be a resource for a long time.
That was my hope.
And it chronicles this fundamental change in American dance music culture.
Yeah.
You sort of hoped it would be one thing, and then at a certain point you realized, well, no, I have to come to terms with the fact that it's going to be another thing.
When I started the book, I thought I was going to end the book with the Rave Act. I didn't think I was going to be writing about EDM at all. I thought I was writing about the 90s. So I spent several months interviewing people with that in mind and gathering things with that in mind. And it wasn't until my friend and colleague and Times contributor Peter Orlov, we were having coffee one day, and I had talked myself out of writing a book for the dozenth time, probably that morning, after a year. And he said, yeah, it's going to be great. You're going to put EDM in the title and you'll sell it. And I thought, of course you're going to put EDM in the title. You have to put EDM in the title and you have to write about EDM. It hadn't even occurred to me until that point because I didn't think I could, you know, I didn't think I was going to understand it to that degree or, you know, the earlier stuff, I knew what I was talking about more.
Mm-hmm.
I had less to learn about the earlier stuff, even though I learned a ton. Whereas with the current stuff, it was really about putting the steps together.
Yeah.
And that was actually the fascinating part for me, was learning how this stuff occurred, learning about how Burning Man was a sort of an on-ramp for it, how dubstep came through Burning Man in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
That's one example.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just talking to a lot of people about this stuff and figuring out the path by which this stuff grew.
Yeah.
An editor at Spin got in touch and was like, we're doing a dance issue. Dance music is about to blow up. And I had gone to this confab Red Bull Music Academy had put together just sort of a headhunting thing, essentially. But I went to that and I remember talking to somebody who said, dance music's going to blow up. And even 6 months of this had not convinced me that it actually was happening because I had seen it before. I'd seen it so many times before. I'd seen, oh, dance music's going to blow up. Oh, dance, you know, over and over every few years for a long time. And at that point, I was just like, no, it isn't.
Mm.
You know, I've seen this happen so many times, but what I hadn't reckoned on was, no, it isn't the dance music I like and that I pay attention to and that's underground in the way that, you know, is comfortable for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's a totally different group of people. It's a totally different set of musical styles.
Right.
And it's out of my realm. So that was a little bit – that was a steep learning curve.
Well, that's the best reason to write a book, really,
yeah.
to come to terms with something,
yes.
to answer questions.
Yeah.
Big questions that you have about something.
Right.
Back to Tropical House.
Yes.
Tropical House is a sound or a set of sounds.
Set of presets.
I mean, at this point, it's not just a vague aesthetic. It's
right.
not just BPM under X number.
Yeah.
It's beginning to be sort of codified.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel open to the possibility that something good can come of it?
Oh, absolutely.
Or do you
yes.
feel that it's just sort of faulty fundamentally.
I'm not a big fan of most of what I've heard so far, but some of it is really intriguingly off, if that makes sense. And I guess that makes it sound like I'm sort of laughing at it. But like some of it I do hear and I'm thinking, if you tweak two or three things a little bit,
yeah.
You know, if you just injected a little taste.
And someone will.
But by that point, it probably won't be as popular because I don't feel like tasteful is really the big thing that a lot of the kids are into with this stuff.
Can you give me one example of something that's almost there?
I thought of including it, but I decided against it because I realized the tempo was too fast. There's this producer in Miami named Eshe Palante, and he made this track called A Discussion Between Saxes.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And he's the person I spoke with that I didn't include. And what's really funny about that track – I mean the track is pretty glorious. It's very cheesy. It's just like a couple of sax parts kind of dueling it out over a beat. You know, it's not enriched. Let's say, mm-hmm. but it's really good. I mm-hmm. really love it. It's very, I played it for a colleague and he was like, wow, Spirit of 86. And that's exactly right. It's mm-hmm. just like this total Michelob ad saxophone.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very cheesy, but I love it. And, you know, there's all kinds of EDM styles and substyles that have coughed up good records.
Mm-hmm.
There's good records to be found. They're just, to me, thinner on the ground than in certain other styles that I dote on more.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I'm always open to good records in those styles because they exist. And it's kind of silly to pretend like they don't, even if they're not exactly to my taste all the time. Like when I go dancing, you know, with the older crowds and the older DJs and whatever that I dote on, I don't want to hear that stuff. That stuff isn't going to work in that setting, but
right.
they work in other settings.
Right. The Coldplay remix
yes.
that Kygo did, that was a commissioned remix. That wasn't just him putting something up on SoundCloud, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
So he's at that level now.
He's at that level. He's got, you know, he's signed to RCA, so
yeah.
he's got all kinds of, you know. I feel like he can kind of pick and choose, or really people are just going to hand him stuff. This is not this is another thing, and I wrote about this a couple of years ago for Spin. The way that a lot of dance producers on major labels, they get signed not just to record and release albums or whatever. A lot of times they're there to produce for artists. They'll like Atlantic or Ultra RCA signs Kygo. And they have this whole roster of people, RCA does, of rock acts that can use some remixes because remixes to get into the dance charts and whatever is still very much a thing.
Right.
That never went away. I didn't include her in the piece, but there's a lot of – probably the most often remixed pop act in Tropical House is Lana Del Rey. And I don't think it's
really?
At all. Yeah. And I don't think it's at all coincidental because I feel like her sort of slow – you know. Nancy Sinatra with a gun slow core
mm-hmm.
really resonates with that audience too.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You know, it's that like moody, semi-gothic, here are lots of strings.
Yeah. And it's a real performance
yes.
of
selfie.
It's selfie?
Yeah, I would say. I know. I mean, that sounds like
a selfie of leisure, but beyond leisure. Of
Here I am in front of a waterfall.
Yeah. Right.
In her case, it's here I am in front of a bloody curtain or whatever. But like, you know, that I mean, that's kind of the shtick. That's the persona.
Yeah.
But very much that's what Tropical House is like, look at me. I'm on vacation.
Now I'm beginning to understand. It's almost
I'm glad it could help.
It's almost a philosophical thing.
Let's not go that far.
Michelangelo Matos, thank you for coming in and talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll go out with Kygo's remix of Coldplay's Midnight. That's our show. Thanks for listening. You can read Michelangelo Matos' piece on Kygo and Tropical House at nytimes.com/music and also read his book, The Underground is Massive, How Electronic Dance Music Conquered America. Our producers are Jocelyn Gonzalez and Jocelyn Gonzalez. And you can look at our playlist, our streaming playlist, to hear examples of Kygo and the other things we've talked about today. Thank you very much. We'll see you next week.